So thank you for being here. This is Star Trek and Social Media, and what I'm going to tell you about is how social media play a role in a unique college course I teach at Syracuse University called Star Trek and the Information Age. And I'm going to give you an idea of, the role that social media plays, but also the content that we talk about in the class and what the class is all about. So I'm going to introduce myself first. I'm Anthony Rotolo. I am a professor at Syracuse University School of Information Studies. And my expertise is in social media, real-time information, and what I'm most known for is teaching a class that on Twitter is known under the hashtag Rotolo class, that the students sort of adopted that hashtag several semesters back now. And that class deals with strategic use of social media, primarily in a business setting or entrepreneurial endeavors, startups and such, and some of it personal strategy. The idea that social media can be applied to goals and leveraged to achieve goals. As all of us here know, that's possible at South By. So I won't get into too much detail about that. I am also the chief explorer, commanding officer of Nexus, which I like to call Starship Nexus. It is my is a center that I have at the school that deals with studying social media, data visualization, data science. Nexus stands for New Explorations in Information Science, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that throughout the course of the talk today. So Rotolo class, actually, what I'm most known for is also infuses a lot of pop culture. This is one way that the class was marketed a semester or so ago. This is me with Rebecca Black, the viral hit on YouTube. I'm driving the car there for her, asking the students which seat will they take in class. So I try to infuse as much pop culture as I can, because what I really want to happen is students, even if they aren't, a lot of students think they know how to use social media, and certainly they do know how to use the social media tools, but to think about it strategically is a little bit different. So I want to pique interest with the way that we might use it as individuals in our everyday lives, and then get them into the seats, which seat will you take, and then go from there, trying to pique the interest that way. So another piece of pop culture that I infuse into the social media class is Harry Potter. The class has grown so big on campus that I actually need to use some Harry Potter, some Hogwarts management systems. So I actually use a sorting hat and I divide the students into the houses of Hogwarts, which helps to manage group projects. Also, we'll assign points and things like that to the houses for good work or answering the questions correctly. Harry Potter fans in the room? Excellent. So you know what I'm talking about. That's my social media sorting hat. Has the logos of a lot of the social media companies, Foursquare badges, things like that on it. So that's sort of what I'm doing in the social media realm. One of the interesting things I'm going to be telling you about the Star Trek class, one of the interesting things was I was in this room for the Potterize panel a couple days ago. And if you were here, you would have heard them talking about the fact that building fan communities and sharing fan content can be difficult when you're sort of trying to walk that fine line with interacting with the brand or Warner Brothers itself and so on that controls the Harry Potter universe. Not so much the case in the Star Trek universe. CBS now is in control of Star Trek, and Star Trek traditionally has been very welcoming, very friendly to fan creations, fan spin-offs. There are whole fan series that are pretty well done, that are online, that Star Trek does not bother and does not try to bother. So I'm actually really fortunate that the work that I'm doing incorporating Star Trek also exists within that realm. So how did Trek class happen? Well, I'm happy teaching my social media course. Everything is going fine. I'm an active participant on Twitter, of course. And I was in a Twitter chat that was dealing with under 30 professionals, young professionals. And one of the topics of discussion at the time was some frustration with the fact that some of these young professionals were saying that they're more senior, more seasoned employees at the company were not allowing them to take leadership on projects. It was challenging to convince a more seasoned employee, more senior employee, to allow that to happen. And there's sort of this paying your dues environment, and how do we get around that? And I just sort of off the cuff made the comment that, well, you know, Captain Picard let Wesley Crusher lead an away team, and the whole idea was to teach him responsibility, right? Why can't that, sort of saying, why can't that happen in companies everywhere? Hashtagged it with Trekkie. It was meant to be sort of a joke, right? And the response was pretty strong to that, saying, wow, you're absolutely right. Oh my God, I love Star Trek. It just was ridiculous, sort of the comments that were coming in. And because my bio says that I teach at Syracuse, and what I teach, I immediately started getting requests that I should really teach a Star Trek course or a course based on Star Trek. So I laughed when I saw that because I said, yeah, right, wouldn't that be awesome if someone would pay me to teach a class on Star Trek? And so I just kind of tucked that away. And then, you know, a couple days later, I was thinking about it. And I thought, well, what the hell? I'll develop a syllabus, see how I can craft a course that would be meaningful around Star Trek, and I'll pitch it and see what happens. And fortunately, the school that I work for, we're known as the iSchool, so spelled the same way as iPad or iPod, information science program at Syracuse. The leadership of our school really encourages entrepreneurship or sort of an entrepreneurial spirit among the faculty and the students. And we have a big focus on entrepreneurship and startups and tech startups. And so that culture permeates everything. And my dean heard about this and she said, do it. Yes, do it. That sounds like a cool idea. Let's see what happens. Let's see if it resonates with students. And so right around the same time as I was getting ready to market the class, The Social Network was out, and this, of course, was the movie poster. You don't get to 500 million friends without making a few enemies. And this, you know, students were all aware of the film and excited to see the film. And so I thought, well, I should tie my background in social media to Star Trek because that's what I'm most known for and try to get people in the seats that way. So I came up with this idea. You don't get to 700 hours of television without getting your own college class. This was papered around campus. It was tweeted out profusely. Facebook page was made around it. All kinds of efforts in the social space to get attention for the class. And I wasn't sure if it worked or anything at first. And registration opened officially on the first day. And within a few hours, the class was full and closed. And our first semester out, we had a full crew in the class of about 80 students, and I've started to panic. Like, okay, now I actually have to deliver this thing. these students are expecting something unique. So, what actually is Trek Class? What am I delivering to the students each week? Well, it's a course that explores contemporary issues of technology, society, leadership, really coming from the perspective of an information science program and from a technology program. Sort of, what are the students who are leaving our program, going out into the workforce as emerging leaders, what are the challenges they're going to face locally and globally when it relates to technology and more broadly the culture that we live in the information age? So that's really what I'm trying to address in the course. And as I thought about planning the class, I realized that Star Trek for 40 plus years has inspired people to pursue science and technology, engineering and math, what in higher ed we call the STEM disciplines, which I thought I could tie this class to doing that, to trying to bring more students into those fields, because often students are unsure how to approach those fields. And I thought if someone had an existing interest or curiosity about science fiction, when they sat in the classroom and heard about how science fiction or fictional technology could become a reality, they might actually decide to try that, to try to explore that. So the tagline is Exploring the Information Age from the Final Frontier. And the class uses a unique mix of social media. So in my social media course, Rotolo class, I use a back channel Twitter discussion the entire time. So no matter what is happening in class, when students come into the room, Turntable FM is actually on the screen for the first 5-10 minutes of class. Students DJ the class. I'm trying to teach them about social content experience. And then we switch over to a Twitter fall, which is the back channel discussion around the hashtag. But it remains in the background of class the entire time. And it's always there. I'm always looking at it. I'm always looking at what the discussion is. And my graduate assistant for the course sort of moderates that back channel discussion a little bit. For Trek class, I realized I had a unique problem. I wanted to show a lot of content. Trek class deals with Star Trek, the original series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, because that's where I can pull the concepts from, the various series. And I realized I'm going to be showing a lot of video, and I've got to recapture the 40 minutes that it takes to watch an episode, because watching clips, just clips, is not enough. I want to approach the topics, but I also want to instill an appreciation for the franchise if I can, because these are solid stories, these are good stories, and I want the students to have the opportunity to see them play out, see all of the content play out. So I thought, what if I took Twitter out of the back channel, made it the front channel, made it the primary method of engaging students for about 40 minutes of the class, then break out into a traditional lecture discussion. And so we came up with a plan where my graduate assistant for Trek class, who's actually sitting sitting with me in the front row, Megan Dornbrock. She's been instrumental in creating the class. I call her the first officer of the class. What we did was we decided that Megan would run a full-fledged Twitter chat. If you've ever been involved in one, you know it's a conversation around a hashtag that uses 4 to 5 questions that are posed to the audience and then discussion around each question. So as we watch the episode, we pose those questions and we get students thinking about the concepts. This is an example of just a quick screen cap of what the Twitter fall looks like on the screen. You can see at the bottom, Trek class actually asking the fourth question of the day, which at the time was dealing with biotechnology. And then we have a few students jumping in with their thoughts. You'll actually see some random questions about the episode itself, which is always nice. Students will ask anything about the content to the fictional side of things. They'll ask, you know, why was a photon torpedo used instead of a phaser, and which one is more powerful? I am not an expert on the details in every case. I know a lot about it, but there are people who really could wipe the floor with me when it comes to Star Trek trivia. So, fortunately, I mentioned Star Trek fandom, and I mentioned CBS being very supportive of that. Star Trek contacted me a few weeks into the class, and I got a little nervous, and I thought, oh no. You know, this could be a problem. And so we did a conference call, and they said, we love what you're doing, and we would like to participate in some way. So at times, in the Twitter chat, the official Star Trek account will jump in and answer those fan questions, which is pretty awesome. You know, what does something mean in Klingon, and you actually get the answer in real time from Star Trek? You really can't beat that. We also use collaborative blogging in the class. The blog for the class is called The Collective. It's named after the Borg Collective. How many Star Trek fans, people really familiar in the room? I would imagine many of you, most of you are. So you know that the Borg is a race of technologically enhanced or cybernetic beings, and they share one hive mind, a collective consciousness. And I thought, what better name for the blog for the class where we're going to be putting our consciousness together and blogging about the concepts. So each class, the collective blog displays a captain's log, which talks about what we'll be talking, which we'll be doing that day in class, and how we're approaching that. And then students are required during the week to add their reflections and their reactions to the blog and then comment and discuss there as well. Blogging is divided up among duty shifts, yes, into the areas of command, tactical, and science. And so depending on which duty shift you are assigned to, the students have to approach the topic for that week from that perspective. And of course, the blog will highlight those different posts with the appropriate colors, red, blue, and gold, around the duty shift areas. And the relationship with StarTrek.com has continued to grow, and in the midpoint of the first semester I offered this, they invited me to create a guest blog at StarTrek.com where they feature monthly one concept from Trek class, and so I write sort of a summary piece of what episode we use and how we tied that to a broader concept of the information age today. And that I'm really honored to be doing that, and that's to bring that content out to the broader Star Trek community is a lot of fun, and it's been very popular as well. Also, for a fan, to be producing content for StarTrek.com is a sort of a dream as well. So what I want to do is, now that I've explained to you what Trek class is, I want to tell you a little bit about what we talk about in the class, what it actually is that we're exploring through the lens of Gene Roddenberry's creation. What can the 23rd and 24th centuries tell us about the time that we live in right now, the fictional 23rd and 24th centuries, as imagined from the 1960s through the early 2000s? Well, one thing we can see by watching Star Trek over that course of time is that the attitudes toward technology, particularly technology intermingled with us in our lives, has changed over time. And I want to explore that with you right now. I'm going to show you a couple of clips. So on the left, you see something known as the M5 computer. It comes from an episode of Star Trek, the original series, called The Ultimate Computer, where the scientist named Daystrom has created an artificial intelligence that's going to take over command of Captain Kirk's Enterprise. And there's some discussion around that. On the right, you see Lieutenant Commander Data, who is an android. He is artificial intelligence. Some think he's artificial life, that he's a sentient being. And he is actually placed on trial to determine whether or not he has the right to control his own fate and destiny. So these are two forms of artificial intelligence, and I want to look at how they are viewed in the 1960s and the late 1980s. So I'll start with the first clip.
Captain's log, stardate 4729.4. The M5 computer has been installed on board ship, and we have left the space station for test maneuvers.
I don't like it, Jim. A vessel this size cannot be run by one computer.
We are attempting to prove that it can run this ship more efficiently than man.
Maybe you're trying to prove that, Spock, but don't count me in on it.
The most unfortunate lack in current computer programming means that there is nothing available to immediately replace the starship surgeon.
Very funny. If it could, they wouldn't have to replace me. I'd resign, because everybody else aboard would be nothing but circuits and memory banks. You know the type, Spock. Jim, you haven't had much to say about this.
What do you want me to say? M5? It's an honor, they tell me. Well, I'm honored.
Fascinating, Doctor. This computer has a potential beyond anything you've ever done. Even your breakthrough in duotronics did not have the promise of this.
The M5 has been perfected, Commander. Its potential is a fact.
Frankly, the only fact that I'm concerned about is if this thing doesn't work, there are not enough men aboard to run the ship, and that's begging for trouble.
M5 is ready to take control of the ship.
Total control?
That is what it was designed for, Captain.
There are certain things men must do to remain men. Your computer would take that away.
There are other things a man like you might do. Or perhaps you object to the possible loss of the prestige and the ceremony accorded a starship captain. The computer can do your job, and without all that.
You'll have to prove that to me, Doctor.
That is what we're here for, isn't it, Captain?
Did you see the love light in Spock's eyes?
The right computer finally came along.
What's the matter, Jim?
I think that thing is wrong. And I don't know why.
Well, I think it's wrong, too, replacing men with mindless machines.
I don't mean that.
I'm getting a red alert right here. That thing is dangerous. I feel... only a fool would stand in the way of progress, if this is progress. You have my psychological profiles. Am I afraid of losing my job to that computer?
Jim, we've all seen the advances of mechanization. After all, Daystrom did design the computers that run this ship
under human control.
We're all sorry for the other guy when he loses his job to a machine, but when it comes to your job, that's different. And it always will be different.
So we see that at this time, in the late 1960s, the idea of technology mingling among us is a foreign idea to most. Computers existed in very high-tech office places, and they were something that maybe you used if you had a very specific job dealing with that. As we move forward in time, we see that that sort of fear goes away, that concern that what will the technology do to us? What will be the impact of having that technology around us? Will I be replaced or not needed or controlled by that technology? Those fears have evolved and changed, and the attitudes have changed. So Daystrom, who created the M5 computer, his institute 100 years later creates Lieutenant Commander Data. And you can see that as he's being defended in the next clip by Captain Picard, the idea of having Data be around on the ship is not scary, nor is the idea of having him as a friend scary. So let's take a look at that.
What are these?
My medals.
Why do you pack them? What logical purpose do they serve?
I do not know, sir. I suppose none. I just wanted them. Is that vanity?
And this?
A gift from you, sir.
You value it?
Yes, sir.
Why?
It is a reminder of friendship and service.
A single Data, and forgive me, Commander, is a curiosity. A wonder even, but thousands of Datas. Isn't that becoming a race? And won't we be judged by how we treat that race? Now tell me, Commander, what is Data? I don't understand.
What is he?
A machine.
Is he? Are you sure?
Yes.
You see, he's met two of your three criteria for sentience, so what if he meets the third? Consciousness, in even the smallest degree. What is he then? I don't know. Do you?
Do you? Do you? Well, that's the question you have to answer.
So now we see Captain Picard arguing in favor of really taking the cautious approach. Well, what if this technology can make its own decisions? What if this technology is sentient? I would like to have this technology around. I would like to know this technology, because not only is this technology an asset, but it's familiar, it's a friend, it's something that I care about. So jumping into the late 1980s, dramatic change as technology started to become more present in everyday lives, less of a concern about that is evident. And what I try to get information science students to think about, technologists to think about, is how do we understand feelings of technology today? How do we understand the way that we approach and adopt technology? And how do we create systems that are approachable and people would like to adopt and integrate into their everyday lives? One of the questions to ask, why do some technologies feel more comfortable than others? Why are there books in the 21st century? When we watch that, you know, it's not only available to be had and packed away in data's prized possessions, but it's something that has an emotional connection still. Why does the book resonate with people still when it's really obsolete? Not obsolete now, but certainly a few hundred years from now, you can imagine that scenario. And so what can we learn about the technologies that we are creating in our field? How can we apply that to creating familiar, approachable technologies? And we're seeing that happen everywhere. We are creating our own data. Whether it's IBM's creation of Watson that can actually defeat Jeopardy champions, it's a triumph of natural language processing. The ability to understand the questions being asked and respond almost as if the technology is human. Or whether it's technologies that we're hearing about while we're at South by, Storify, which is auto-magically creating stories about our adventures here at South by. Are these the types of technologies that are comfortable to us? Well, yes, increasingly they are. We want them integrated into our lives, and we're comfortable with that. But only to a certain point. So as Star Trek continues down its timeline, we see that what the technology itself is not a fear. What becomes the fear is loss of humanity to the technology, to the technology not being next to us or around us, but being inside of us. And so if you are not familiar with the Borg, as I told you, they are technologically enhanced, and they're using biotechnology in their bodies, sharing a hive mind. A Borg drone is linked to that hive mind. And that becomes something that seems very foreign, very different.
On screen.
I am Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Jean-Luc Picard, captain of the Starship Enterprise Registry NCC-1701D. You will lower your shields and prepare to transport yourself aboard our vessel. If you do not cooperate, we will destroy your ship.
You have committed acts of aggression against the United Federation of Planets. If you do not withdraw immediately...
You will surrender yourself or we will destroy your ship. Your defensive capabilities are unable to withstand it.
What the hell do they want with you?
I thought they weren't interested in human life forms, only our technology.
Their priorities seem to have changed.
And shield's failing. Chapter Beam has locked on.
So Captain Picard is abducted by the Borg and assimilated into the Borg collective. And he becomes Locutus of Borg, which is a human mouthpiece for the collective to communicate to the people of Earth why they will be assimilated and, more importantly, why resistance is futile. As, of course, it always is, right? And so we see... We can compare the Borg technology to things that we have in our own world today, whether they are for medical purposes to help people who have a need for that type of technology, or whether they be things we choose to attach to ourselves. Many of us have mobile devices strapped to our bodies as we walk around. Many of us have Bluetooth devices, although you don't see that as much anymore, people wearing them as a fashion statement. But that little, whenever I saw somebody with the little Bluetooth headset, the little blinking light all the time, the first thing I always thought was a Borg drone. You know, we see that, but we see that there is a concern, whether it is hearing about, if anyone's read the book, The Shallows, right? What is the internet doing to us? Is internet culture making us dumber? We hear concerns like that from a very high-minded academic perspective. And we also hear students, parents, mom and dad saying, can you please stop texting at the dinner table? You know, what is wrong with you? Why can't you engage with people in real life anymore? Because the thing is, we really are a lot more like the Borg than we realize. On the left is a picture that was taken at Syracuse University's graduation last year. And that's one row in the Carrier Dome, which was one of the largest on-campus sports facilities, full of thousands of students as they graduate. And almost every student on the floor is looking at a screen while they are graduating. On the right, look up in any college classroom, look in front of you today, and this is what we see. And the question is this a problem? We certainly don't think so. Those of us here at South by Southwest, we think this is enabling all kinds of possibilities to happen that were never possible before. And that is true, because we know what's going on with those students is that they're engaging in a conversation. They're enhancing their graduation experience through connecting with family and friends during it. We know that the students, in my classroom at least, are not only choosing to tweet and engage in a discussion, they're required to tweet and engage in a discussion. So, yes, we may be like the Borg, but what is the line? Where do we draw the line? Are the Borg the ultimate social network, or is it something before that, the point where we would like to reach? And so I asked the students to approach that in a project for class. It's called The Case for Assimilation. And it's almost sort of like a modest proposal, if you've ever read that, Jonathan Swift, where I ask the students to create their own project as Locutus of Borg. They adopt the persona of Locutus of Borg, and they communicate to the people of Earth just exactly why it's better to just go ahead and be assimilated, why resistance is futile. And what this allows the students to do is examine technology and culture of our current age and determine a lot of things about how we use technology, what our attitudes are about technology, and they then present that case. And they are allowed to do it in creative ways. Some have made videos, some have made narrative stories, some have made scripts, some have made hand-drawn comics. On the left, you see one student raising the idea that even though we say that we want to maintain our individuality, for all the people that have Nike products and watch MTV shows, I wouldn't necessarily call that individuality, right? We all adopt a certain branding, so that's the claim that he's making in that case. On the right, you just see an interpretation of Locutus and saying it's time to become one with the technology. So I think this project, it's an early project in the course, gets students thinking in that way. And while we explore the Borg confrontation and we explore the episode, The Best of Both Worlds, in which that happens, there's another confrontation taking place that's really relevant to today's college students, especially those that are moving out into the work world. Commander Riker on the left, the first officer of Captain Picard's Enterprise, is a seasoned officer. He has chosen to remain on the Enterprise under Captain Picard rather than taking his own command several times. And he is a company man in a lot of ways. On the right is a Lieutenant Commander Shelby. She is a guest star on the episode. She is a Borg expert, a young up-and-comer, somebody to watch out for. And the conflict between the two of them, I'm going to tell you what I tie that to after we watch this little clip.
I've reviewed your personnel. I'll be assigning Mr. LaForge and Mr. Data to accompany me on the away team.
I've already assigned them to the away team. And I'll be with you as well, Commander.
Of course. I appreciate any assistance you can offer. Tell me, Commander, is serving aboard the Enterprise as extraordinary an experience as I've heard?
Every bit.
Good. Because I intend to convince Captain Picard that I'm the right choice for the job.
Job? Which job?
Yours, of course. I'm sorry. I heard that you were leaving.
If I were, I'm sure you'd be the first to know.
Time index 514. Data started to fluctuate phasor resonance frequencies. The Borg's beam breaks contact
and program. Unfortunately, there is one slight detail. In the process, the blast completely destroys the Enterprise as well. There is one other recommendation I'd like to make, Commander. Separate the saucer section. Assign a skeleton crew to create a diversion.
We may need the power from the saucer's impulse engines.
But it would give them more than one target to worry about.
It's too great a risk.
I'd
like the captain to make that decision, sir.
Commander, I bring all the alternatives to the captain's attention. That'll be all. Come.
Come in, number one. Commander Shelby was just telling me of your concerns about her plan.
I'm sorry if she troubled you, sir. I have already informed her.
Yes, I entirely agree with you, number one. It's not the time. But the time may come when we will be required to take greater risks. I want you to consider her plan as a fallback position. Make the necessary preparations.
Very good, sir.
Decade, Battlebridge.
Halt. Commander, you and I need to have a conversation.
You never ordered me not to discuss this with the captain.
You disagree with me? Fine. You need to take it to the captain? Fine. Through me. You'd do an end run around me again? I'll snap you back so hard you'll think you're a first-year cadet again.
May I speak frankly, sir?
By all means.
You're in my way.
Really? How terrible for you.
All you know how to do is play it safe. I suppose that's why someone like you sits in the shadow of a great man for as long as you have, passing up one command after another. Proceed to deck 8.
When it comes to this ship and this crew, you're damned right I play it safe.
If you can't make the big decisions, Commander, I suggest you make room for someone who can.
Possibly the most awkward moment in all of Star Trek. And what I tie this to in class is, you know, the students that are in my classroom, they are what we call members of the millennial generation. And that term has a lot of connotations to it. And so I take a look at the difference in, or what is said to be the difference in culture between the millennial generation and the baby boom generation, which is currently in mostly in leadership positions in companies and exiting soon, and the millennial generation moving in. And there is a lot of disconnect. You know, in social media, how many of you work in social media in this room? Okay. We are criticized all the time for there being a lot of gurus and ninjas, right, out there who do social media, and rightfully so. Some of that is good criticism. That's nothing compared to the millennial experts that are out there. The people who will train baby boomers how to understand millennials. Okay, because that it's a lot of trumped up charges saying that millennials are expect to be CEO overnight, that they or to start out as a CEO, they expect, as you hear Shelby say, you're in my way, they expect to do end runs around people, they expect to jump from company to company to company every other month trying to find a place that fits for them. These are a lot of charges, and there are a lot of books and a lot of literature. 60 Minutes did a tremendously terrible piece on it that I have the students watch in class where it comes off as old people saying, I just don't get these kids, right? And so I ask the students in class to talk about what they really view the work world like. They've all been out in internships. They all have worked with more senior people. And so I ask them to discuss that. We do a full-fledged discussion around workplace issues for employees who are coming out with tech skills, new ideas, just like Shelby has new ideas, that they want to work in, that they want to get an opportunity to use. And how do you find that balance? How do you make that possible? And you know what a lot of the students actually say? All this millennial stuff's a lot of BS, okay? They say, we understand that more seasoned professionals are people we can learn from. These are people that we want to work with. Yes, sometimes they're slow. Yes, sometimes they don't understand social media. Yes, sometimes they probably should let me lead and it will be faster, but there is value in the collaboration. Of course, in the outcome of the Shelby Riker situation, putting their ideas together, as you might imagine, is what makes the successful defeat of the Borg in that episode. So just something to keep in mind, and I think that's an important concept for us to look at. And also I want to point out that we often have non-traditional undergraduates in class, folks who actually are returning students, members of a generation that are not your current cohort of college student. And that discussion is often phenomenal in class, to hear those different perspectives. One of the things I like the most about the course. So a couple of other concepts I just want to quickly get through so that you have an idea of the full scope of the class. We talk about unemployment. We start by talking about unemployment, how we handle it, how technology can help address unemployment issues and economic issues. I use Deep Space Nine's two-part episode, Past Tense, in which Commander Sisko and Dr. Bashir are accidentally transported back in time to the year 2024 in San Francisco. And they find a very different world from what we would expect just a few years in our future in 2024, in which sanctuary districts have been created for the homeless and the unemployed. And these are really concentration camps where services are supposed to be delivered to help these people, but they're really living in slums and ghettos and fending for themselves. What's really interesting about that concept is it sounds like sort of a very dire view of the future, a warning from Star Trek. Good science fiction often allows us to see and be warned about the future, possible futures. As that episode was being filmed, it had been written for quite some time, as it was being filmed, news came out of California that some cities had proposed sanctuary districts for the homeless. So it was, if you watch the DVDs of this episode, the writers will talk about just being shocked to hear that literally in the process of filming the episode. So what ends up happening in the episode, there's a riot around from the people who are in the sanctuary districts, and the way that riot actually, the way that plays out and the way that the resolution comes about, the way that they reach other people, is through something called the net. Right? As imagined from the mid-1990s by the writers of Star Trek, the net makes it possible for them to get their message out and to reach other people and to get a solution. So if we fast forward to today, we understand that social media and the internet is what makes it possible for everything from the Arab Spring to allow people to connect and to communicate and to organize, and also right here in America, the Occupy movements that are really our own version of social movements being fueled by social networking. And so in the context of this discussion, I jump from talking about unemployment and what technology can do to address that type of problem, but to talking about things like net neutrality, talking about things like SOPA and the proposed legislation to control social media space, things like that. Because in the episode, it's very clear that the net is under the control of the government and corporate interests, and it makes it very difficult for that organization to happen. So we have that SOPA, PIPA debate around this concept, these episodes. A couple of other concepts. On the left, an episode called Relics, where Scotty, who was the chief engineer aboard Captain Kirk's Enterprise, is found to have been stuck in the transporter buffer for almost 100 years in an effort to save himself during a ship-wide disaster. He devised a plan to go into the transporter buffer, and LaForge, who is the chief engineer aboard Picard's Enterprise almost 100 years later, brings him out of the transporter. And we find Scotty to be a person out of time. His skills are not relevant any longer, and he has a very difficult time adapting to the new environment. And so I use that episode to address the idea of retooling for a knowledge economy. What do we do to help people who have lost their jobs in industries that are declining, like manufacturing? We talk about this. We talk a lot about Detroit and the auto industry. How can people retool for a knowledge economy? What types of skills are necessary? What is too much to expect of folks who are that senior at that point? What types of jobs could they do? And so that's a very robust discussion. Also, how do we preserve the information we create? On the right is a shot from the very famous Star Trek episode, The Inner Light, often cited as the greatest episode of Star Trek in any series, in which Captain Picard is affected by an alien probe in a way that within 20 minutes of real time, he actually experiences the entire life of another person, an alien aboard a planet known as Catan. And in that process, he experiences what Catan was like and the life on Catan, and then realizes when he awakens that he now has full memory of that, and he is a living archive of the society that was Catan. And so I use this episode to talk about how we make selections about what we're going to archive and what we're not going to archive in an age in which everything we have is digital. And in theory, if our own personal computer crashes, we lose so much. Imagine the technology that controls so much of our lives and so much of our world, and how do we decide what we would like to tell other people about ourselves in the future? One project that's going to be coming up in Trek class next semester is I'm actually going to have students create their own Catan time capsule probe for our own society. So to decide what type of information we would try to archive and how we would approach that from a digital perspective to archive that content and information. Some things are very difficult to do in that way. And lastly, one of the final projects in the class is, can technology make us feel less responsible for our actions? On the left, Captain Janeway aboard Voyager, there's some aliens on the ship in an episode called Scientific Method, where they have a technology that allows them to shift themselves out of phase so that the other people on the Voyager cannot see the aliens aboard. And they're having science experiments conducted on the crew. The crew feels the effects, but they don't know the experiments are being done. And the aliens feel comfortable in that, because they don't have to look into the faces of the people who are in pain because of their science experiments. On the right, Captain Sisko brings the Romulans into the Dominion War in an episode called In the Pale Moonlight, and he does that by hiding behind forged holographic technology that he shows of a very high-level meeting that convinces the Romulans that they are in danger. And Sisko says at the end in his monologue, "I can live with it." Right? And so this idea that no one knows he's been behind this technology, he can live with that. And so I translate that into today, is it easier to hurt other people from behind a screen? On the right, you see cyberbullying, right? And students are allowed to approach that concept using those episodes. On the left, you see unmanned aerial drones. Is it easier to conduct war when we don't have to be on the ground, when we can control it from behind a screen, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away? And so, to sum up this concept, the final clip that I want to show you is Captain Kirk from an episode called A Taste of Armageddon. In a very excellent Captain Kirk monologue, you will hear his views on the topic. In Taste of Armageddon, the Enterprise crew has arrived on a planet that has been at war for 500 years. And in order to make that war more efficient and less damaging, they've created computer technologies on both worlds that are at war, in which virtual attacks are launched on each other. Victims are produced at random from the computer. Those victims must report to extermination chambers within 24 hours. And actually are exterminated. This horrifies Captain Kirk and his crew, and you'll see the resolution.
Death, destruction, disease, horror. That's what war is all about, Anon. That's what makes it a thing to be avoided. You've made it neat and painless. So neat and painless, you've had no reason to stop it. And you've had it for 500 years. Since it seems to be the only way I can save my crew and my ship, I'm going to end it for you, one way or another.
Do you realize what you have done?
Yes, I do.
I've given you back the horrors of war. The Vendicans will now assume that you've broken your agreement, preparing to wage real war with real weapons. They'll want to do the same. Only the next attack they launch will do a lot more than just count up numbers on a computer. They'll destroy your cities, devastate your planet. You, of course, will want to retaliate. If I were you, I'd start making bombs. Yes, Councilman, you have a real war on your hands. You can either wage it with real weapons, or you might consider an alternative. Put an end to it. Make peace.
Don't you see? We've admitted it to ourselves. We're a killer species. It's instinctive. It's the same with you.
All right. It's instinctive. The instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands. But we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. Knowing that we're not going to kill today. Contact Bendikar. I think you'll find that they're just as terrified, appalled, horrified as you are. That they'll do anything to avoid the alternative I've given you. Peace or utter destruction. It's up to you.
So, Kirk makes his views very clear, possibly in direct violation of the Prime Directive. but that's okay. Kirk didn't follow that very often anyway. And so you see a formidable captain there, an argument being made. He's a very charismatic commanding leader. We saw Picard doing the same thing in defense of Data. And so I want to tell you a little bit about the final project for Trek class. This is how the class was marketed this last semester, to decide, let's settle this once and for all, Kirk or Picard, who is the best captain. And I actually upped the ante a little bit. I included all four captains that we look at, and the final assignment for the course is we do reading and we take a look at some management philosophies, management theories, leadership theories, and then the students do their own independent research based on what we saw in class, based on some recommended episodes that they can watch on their own. The students create a report talking about the strengths and weaknesses and command decisions of the various captains and how that relates to the management principles that we talk about, and then they make a recommendation as to who is the most formidable or who is the best captain. I'm about to tell you. I have never shared this before. So right here at South By, I will share for the first time the results of a semester's worth of looking at all four of these captains. And it looks something like this. Yeah. Captain Picard, certainly he wins in that debate. Kirk, it has a formidable showing. And I think what's significant is Captain Janeway, she gets a lot of fans during the course of the semester, and a lot of the students have never seen Voyager before. And so what's really interesting is that Janeway, and the question being, is it all the women, right, who want to support the female captain? Not at all. Male students resonate with, Janeway resonates with male students just as much as female students, and everything that I can determine anecdotally and from what they write in their papers. Now, this is not obviously formal research, but this is from what the students are doing. Sisko, I will say in his defense, we don't watch as much Deep Space Nine in class as we do the other captains. But I think we really want to know Kirk and Picard anyway, right? So there is your answer. Let's talk about a little bit more real research. I told you about Nexus, my social media starship. And in that research center, we are actually beginning to do research on the methods I'm using of using social media as primary methods of engaging students. And one of the things we're doing is we're mapping, I actually have a paper coming out with a colleague, Dr. Ruth Small, who's an expert in motivation in learning environments, and it's expected to come out soon in a journal called Future Learning. And we are mapping the concepts in the class and the practices used in the class to what's known as the ARCS model of motivation. It's a well-established theory, and it looks at attention, relevance, confidence, and satisfaction among students. And so we're tying the different aspects, particularly the social media aspects of the class, to fostering those areas of that theory. And we see that pretty strongly in both my social media class known as Rotolo class and in the Star Trek class. And I actually, based on this, I'm going to be tweaking the Star Trek class a little bit more to target some of these areas, which I think will continue to help motivate students. And some more hardcore research is coming very soon. We're actually taking a look at, we are capturing all Twitter data around my courses. Thousands and thousands of tweets are generated monthly around my class hashtags, and we're going to literally code and analyze every single tweet to try to map those tweets to show when students are engaged, motivated, when they are interacting with each other outside of class, when they are doing things around learning that they would not ordinarily do or would not easily do in an average college course that does not use, a typical college course that does not use these types of technologies. And so we're in the process of collecting and coding that data now, and I actually will be able, and we're surveying the students as well, traditional survey before, survey after of their attitudes toward the technology and such. And I will actually be giving updates on this research at the 140 conference in New York City in June, and also, believe it or not, at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas in August. Yes, which again, I mentioned a fan's dream. Yes, I will be giving something like what you just saw and heard today, a micro version of Trek class at the Star Trek convention. So if any of you are planning to attend, please do check that out. That is all I have to share with you. I want to do some questions if anybody has any. Thank you. Thank you. There's a mic in the center. Sure.
Hello. Check. So you're awesome. This class is amazing. You know, I give a lot of presentations to schools and universities around the country and around the world, and I just don't understand why so many people don't get it. And it seems like you get it so much. I mean, you use social media in the classroom. Your presentations are actually interesting. Your talk is actually insightful. And so I wonder, have you been approached by other academia around the country on lessons learned, on how they can make their educational curriculums more interesting, kind of like you've done here? Because I can only imagine that you probably have waiting lists for your classes at Syracuse. And, I mean, you probably attract students to Syracuse specifically just to attend classes like this. So I want to applaud you and just see if there's any anything that you've been able to advise others on regarding this. That was a long question.
Okay. Sort of thank you. I appreciate that. Yes, the answer to your question about being approached on that topic is yes, and it happens both formally and informally. Actually, right here at South By, I've met a lot of other college professors who have asked me something very similar to that, some that will be teaching for the first time. My very short answer, which is I certainly could give a lot more details if any of you are instructors, my very short answer is imagine you're the student and give them what they would want to see. Right, because I think a lot of college professors don't think about the choreography of a college class. Right, you have to keep it seamless, and a lot of college professors will like to walk in with their notes. Yes, we're all experts on something, and wing it. Well, guess what? People know when you wing it, and students are really sensitive to that. And in this age of social media, when a student can not only rate your class on some website and tell other students that it sucks, they can tell them in real time with Twitter that it sucks. And just like at South By, if you didn't like what you heard today, you would have told other people and you would have got up and you would have left for another panel that you heard was awesome. The same thing happens in colleges. You can drop a class in the first few weeks. And so that's my short advice. And I can certainly talk tactics with any of you if you are instructors. And it does happen formally as well. We're taking a look at the Trek class specifically and trying to see if I can turn this into a model that can be packaged up and used at other colleges. And we're seeking some grant funding around that to see if we can do that. And also, there's a high likelihood that this course will become a book soon so that others could use it in whatever context they wanted to. Go ahead.
All right, so two questions, actually. First one is, I have a thing with Trek where I think that every single writer that has been on Trek is afraid of technology. So I see where you're going for your first topic, and I find it kind of curious that you use data as an example of accepting technology, because then they introduce lore,
yes,
which is the anti-data.
Yes.
And it's the same paradigm, right? Everything, they're always comparing. So I'd like to get your opinion on that. And the second question is, I teach a social media course, which is very similar in logistics to what you do. I don't delve into Trek, but I do a lot of what you do. Okay. I have a screen in the back showing tweets all the time. I take a lot of statistics and whatnot. I use Twitter visualizations as they sit and walk in. I'd just like to get a little bit more information as to other things that you do. Turntable, I think, is genius.
Yeah, thank you.
And, you know, maybe get a couple of tips and whatnot.
Sure, sure. Okay, so the first thing about the fears of technology, all the Star Trek writers being afraid of technology, I don't think it's as much that as it is. Go ahead. Yeah, the sci-fi writers, good sci-fi writers, are often looking to address either a point of contention in our own society, or something that we're headed toward, possibly in our own society. And I think that a lot of Star Trek writers have realized that within our culture, over time, people have been fearful of technology. So they've created and put through in the dialogue that type of environment. But it's certainly their own views at the time, certainly in the late 1960s. Kirk and McCoy discussing the M5 computer, that is definitely showing the cultural views of artificial intelligence or the idea of what artificial intelligence could be at the time, if people were even thinking about it, right? But I think by the time you get to Data in the 80s and Deep Space Nine and Voyager in the 90s, anything that deals with the Borg as a threat, as a technology that we should be concerned about, I think at least in my opinion, is more the writers viewing that as potentially a fear people have and would make good storytelling, right? So I think that's how that comes through. To the second part of your question, Turntable is something newer that I'm doing. I want students to understand the concept of social networks or social experiences built around shared content in real time. So that's why I use Turntable FM. The students resonate. It resonates with students very well because the students can play whatever they want, and usually I enjoy it, and that gives them a thrill as well, because I'll crank up some song that I like or something like that. It just gets everybody excited for the class, gets everybody talking. Students are squatting turntable spots on the DJ table, you know, 20, 30 minutes before the class starts from their iPhone apps now, because they want to be the ones that play the song. I think collaborative blogging is something I really want to push into a lot more. It hasn't, in all honesty, hasn't worked for me to the degree that I thought it would. It's effective in some ways, not effective in all ways than I thought it would. And part of that is because the technology, there's a little bit of a learning curve, because we use WordPress as a blogging platform, and some of the students said that they think they need a degree in WordPress first in order to post the blogs formatted the way they want to. So that's really the one I would say is the collaborative blogging I would like to drive more forward into. Yes?
Pretty much a staple kind of question for all social media is, do you think just because we're connecting more, we just society in general, are they better connections, though? Because I think that a lot of people now, I mean, this is like a very common question. Yes, we're having all of these other connections, but are they actually good connections? Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, you can tweet right away and you have constant information, but that's all focused on me. Like,
yeah.
I just want me.
Yeah.
So if you could elaborate on your thoughts on that.
I think social networking and social media are extensions of human needs that already exist. And I think just as in real life, when you make a connection with someone, you can choose to make that a rich and productive connection, or you can choose to make that an acquaintance in name only. And I think the same thing is true for social networking. If you make an online connection, you can actively build that relationship, you can actively discuss, you can be a part of that person's existence as much as they're part of yours. And in my classes, I see that in a real way. The student community, one of the things I want to try to measure in that Twitter data we're taking is that the community the students build in my classes is, in my experience, unheard of. The students get to know each other on such a personal level, and they are become friends in such a real way that I think is a unique scenario. And also, a lot of guest speakers and experts, when I start mentioning cases and things like case studies and things in class, those companies themselves will actually come right into our Twitter feed in real time and start talking to the students and answering questions. And I think that's very real and very relevant as well. So, you know, I see a lot of advantages. I hear what you're saying about that concern. I've heard it a lot myself, and I do think it goes back to it is what you put into it, right, is what you get back out of it.
Is there a reason why you don't use Enterprise? Is it because it sucks?
I think you know the reason, yeah.
It's the theme tune.
Well, part of it is also because there's only so much time in the semester to hit the things I want, and if Enterprise has a concept, the series Enterprise was the last one to air on TV, and most Star Trek fans unanimously agree that it sucked. So if Enterprise has a concept that I want to use, and I can pull that concept from something in one of the more well-known series, I'll use the other series, just because I don't necessarily want to introduce another captain, another crew, and all that to the class, because students who don't have a full understanding of Star Trek do struggle when it's too much change with the crew and the characters and things like that. Also, it's my least favorite series, so there's that too.
Yeah. I have one more. There's an episode, I think it's called The High Ground,
okay,
which was banned. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was banned in the US, it was banned in the UK and Europe, because mm-hmm. I think it had like Nazi connotations and
yes.
links to terrorism. And
do you know if it was banned?
Not in the US.
Okay, was it edited? I think it may have been edited but not banned in the US or something like that.
I was
yeah.
just wondering if yeah. that was something that you'd thought about using in the class or you had looked at it all.
Fair enough, I think that's actually a good suggestion. I had not thought about that, but it might be interesting to do that, definitely.
My brother actually teaches geology,
mm-hmm.
and he has completely the opposite tact.
Okay.
He comes in and he tells everyone, they turn your phones off. If I see a photo mm-hmm. on, you kick out of the class.
Yeah.
He ends up actually, he has found that his students' grades go up when he does
okay.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually, surprisingly enough, one of the most highest rated
yes.
professors.
Yes.
Do you think maybe it has something to do with the content?
Yes.
Like you can talk about Star Trek on Twitter,
no.
but you can't talk about geology on Twitter?
No. I think you can, in some ways, yes. But I think one of the misconceptions is that my students like my class because they get to to tweet during class, but it's not so much that. It's not so much that they get to use the technology, is that I'm asking them to use the technology for a very specific reason, right? They're actually discussing the content. It does not, yes, geology would be harder than social media or Star Trek to talk about, no question. But I'm leading them through a discussion and actually utilizing that back channel so they know what goes up there as part of the class. And so using that technology, yeah, they might bounce off to the side and check their Facebook page or something like that, but there is a constant feedback system going on there, and there's a constant expectation. So I think it's a little bit different than sort of being the professor that says, I don't care if you use your phone, right? That's a little bit different. Also, one of the things I really want to study, this reminds me to say, is after we take a look at the Twitter data that I'm doing now, I'm planning to work with another colleague who specializes in learning disabilities. I want to look at whether or not what I'm doing makes it easier or harder for a student with certain learning disabilities. I actually anecdotally have at least theories that because of the repetition of when I'm saying things in class, when it comes across Twitter, when it's being retweeted and retweeted and retweeted and reinterpreted, I actually think some students with attention difficulties are actually benefiting from that. So I want to see if we can show that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here.